loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we dive into Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's first days in office and discuss the U.S.-Mexico border, his press conferences stating a planned break from Mexico's past neoliberalist policies, and his fight against corruption, a new day in Mexico. We're going to talk about it in depth. And then we continue our weekly series called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe announced this morning that the fuel tax that set off rioting around the country will be suspended for 6 months. The yellow vest protests have grown to include other issues, however, reflecting widespread anger at President Macron for his failure to improve living standards. Next, former President George H.W. Bush died over the weekend at the age of 94. His body is currently lying in state in the U.S. Capitol, and a funeral will take place tomorrow. We'll look at the Bush presidency and the Bush legacy each day this week, focusing on a different issue. Today, we'll talk about his role in the coup that overthrew Haiti's democratically elected government in 1991. Then, the European Court of Justice's Advocate General delivered a non-binding opinion yesterday that the UK could arbitrarily cancel its decision to withdraw from the European Union if it so chose. The decision comes as the House of Commons begins a week of debate on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan, and Parliament found the government in contempt this morning for not issuing Brexit advice. And then Israel's military says that it has begun an operation to destroy what it calls cross-border attack tunnels under its border with Lebanon dug by Hezbollah operatives. An Israeli government spokesman said the tunnels had only recently been detected and they will be destroyed without having to cross the border into Lebanon. But is this, in fact, motivated by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's legal and political problems at home? And finally, Nexstar Media Group announced yesterday that it will buy Tribune Corporation's 42 television stations and its cable network in an all-cash $4.1 billion deal. An earlier takeover attempt by Sinclair Media was blocked by the Federal Communications Commission. If approved, the company will own more than 200 television stations covering 39% of all American households. And in other headlines, CIA Director Gina Haspel reportedly gave a private briefing on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi to members of the Senate today. The Democratic and Republican leaders of the Foreign Relations, Appropriations, and Armed Services Committees, plus Senate Democratic and Republican leaders, were all invited to attend. The Trump administration's reluctance to send Haspel to testify on Khashoggi had been a major source of tension between the White House and the Senate. 49 years ago today, Black Panther Party members Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed in a raid by the FBI, the Chicago Police Department, and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Hampton was widely recognized as a talented organizer, and he chaired the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party and was deputy chairman of the National Party. The raid was facilitated by an FBI undercover agent who infiltrated the Black Panther Party, and the operation was later revealed to be a part of the larger FBI COINTELPRO program. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals panel struck down a provision of a federal law that makes it illegal to encourage immigrants to enter the country illegally. The panel found that the provision was unconstitutional because it infringes on free speech rights. The law was implemented prior to Donald Trump taking office, but this is seen as another rebuke to his hardline anti-immigration position from a circuit that he has openly criticized multiple times. After some debate, Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, declared today that he will not run for president in 2020. He cited his family's request that he not run and added, quote, "The Democratic Party must immediately recognize that many of the likely candidates are not battle-tested and have no real chance at winning. We will not prevail in 2020 without a fighter," end quote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the inauguration of the new Mexican president. Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was inaugurated on Saturday and began his six-year term with a press conference, something unusual for Mexican presidents. He promised to bring what he called, quote, "deep and radical change," close quote, in his fight against crime, and even held a meeting with his national security team at 6 a.m. today, something he said would happen daily. López Obrador said that he had, quote, a respectful relationship, close quote, with President Donald Trump, but it promises to turn rocky in negotiations over migrants and a border wall. And Obrador has proposed sweeping changes in the country's economic policy to break from neoliberalism. We're joined from Mexico City by Dr. John Ackerman. Dr. Ackerman is a professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, researcher at the Legal Research Institute of UNAM, and editorial director of the Mexican Law Review. Dr. Ackerman, welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you, as always.
How big is this for Mexico?
It's enormous. This is, you know, the first time we've had a progressive president since 1940. It's almost 80 years of conservative and more recently, you know, neoliberal presence. Mexico had been left out of the massive political changes occurring throughout Latin America over the last 30 years. You know, there was a real political response to neoliberalism in the 90s, first decade of the 21st century, in just about every country. And we had it too in Mexico, of course. We had a massive popular participation in the elections of 1988, 2006 as well. Both of those elections were stolen from the opposition progressive candidate, left-wing candidate. But finally, we've broken through. The indignation and the hope as well of the Mexican people finally broke through. You know, it was a real blowout, 53%, and second place was 22. And we've gone through about 5 months of a transition period, and finally, it's come true. You know, many people sort of didn't quite believe it until this Saturday, you know, in which he was actually, López Obrador, handed the presidential sash and had his ceremony and occupied National Palace, and very symbolically, you know, opened up Los Pinos, which is the White House of Mexico, a very luxurious, vast residence, presidential residence full of expensive chandeliers and, you know, a huge gym and swimming pools. And, you know, they've opened that up to the public. He's not going to use that as his office. And so it's very similar, a symbolic kind of revolutionary moment in which the people can sort of explore the lavish lifestyle of the previous presidents, and that's the idea, that we're starting a new historic stage in Mexico.
Dr. Ackerman, President López Obrador has promised a lot of different things, a lot of progressive policies, things like creating a national institute for attention to indigenous peoples, or universal health care, especially for those in outlying areas, 10 million new scholarships for students at all levels, doubling of pensions. Are these ideas actually implementable? Is there money to do it?
Well, you know, Mexico is the 14th largest economy in the world. We have 125 million inhabitants, incredible natural resources. Even despite the downscaling of the Mexican economy due to NAFTA, we still have a pretty strong industrial sector, commercial sector, agriculture. You know, it's a big economy. The problem is that so much of this income has been skimmed off both by the oligarchs on one hand and by the corrupt politicians on the other hand. And so very little has actually gone into social investment. And the money that actually does go down to the people is often used for, you know, clientelistic policies, vote buying. And so, you know, really setting the Mexican government on its feet could create a real renaissance in many different sectors. And López Obrador has promised that he is not going to raise taxes. Now, this might sound conservative, neoliberal, but it's not actually necessary to raise taxes, at least immediately, in order for the government to increase its income. Due to tax evasion, we lose incredible amounts of money. Offshore fiscal paradises, for instance, you know, we're only taking in about 13% of GDP in taxes in Mexico, which is like half of or less than half of the United States. And the United States gets over 30%. Brazil is also around 30%. You know, Nordic countries bring in almost 50%. And so just on, you know, our highest tax rate is 34%. So if you just actually charge that to the wealthiest income sector, the 1%, you know, in Mexico, we could, you know, double government resources and use that to fund all these, you know, social development and, you know, basic welfare state projects. López Obrador is not talking about nationalization. He's talking about, you know, the social justice and you know, recuperating the welfare state. And, you know, he has the law on his side, which is a good thing, because our Constitution was written in 1917 after, you know, the final moment of the Mexican Revolution, Zapata, Villa, Carranza, Obregón. And so it has in it our Constitution, like all sorts of social guarantees, you know, basic guarantees to work, to land, to healthcare, to education, which have not been fulfilled. And so the idea is to start at least moving towards those objectives in this historical moment.
Politically, John Kiriakou and Dr. Ackerman, that's so critically important. In other words, the new president claims the legacy of Mexico, the unfulfilled legacy, the dreams, the aspirations. It's not starting over. When we talk about something being radical, it doesn't necessarily mean something that's brand new. It means going back to the roots, and what we're talking about, the roots of the Mexican Revolution, which are goals and aspirations, but they need policies, and they need especially priorities, like what part of society is the priority of the government. I mean, we had in the mid-1930s the historic presidency of Cárdenas, the nationalization of oil, the creation of a welfare state of sorts. Mexico played that role in the hemisphere, you know, the leadership role, certainly for Latin America, a decisive role. It would seem to me, given the size of Mexico and the size of Mexico's economy, that Mexico could be poised to return to that sort of leadership role, not only for the people of Mexico, but for the people of the hemisphere. Anyway, what do you think?
Yeah, well, that's the idea. We're in such a depressed state in terms of politics in the world in general, in the Americas and Europe. You know, we're getting all these radical right-wing fascist backlashes against the system. And it's so refreshing to see a different kind of response. You know, we have a global process of disillusionment, you know, with liberal democracy. And unfortunately, in many countries, this has been pushing towards these kinds of, you know, Bolsonaro or Trump figures. I see them in the same boat, you know, Macri or Macron. Look what's happening to France and Argentina as well. Both these guys also presented to themselves as sort of these new innovators who are going to put things back on their feet, but ended up being, you know, the same old new neoliberal policies. And the people, both in Argentina and France, are realizing this. But in Mexico, we're taking a different route. We didn't go with our Macri or Macron. We didn't go with our Trump or Bolsonaro. We went with, you know, the old stalwart who is proposing new ideas, even though they go back to the Mexican Revolution. This would actually be radically new to implement these very progressive ideals which were installed in the Mexican Constitution since 1917. Like you said, yes, this is fascinating synthesis of past and present, of struggle and of social struggle and of recuperating public institutions, that I think definitely does place Mexico today as a real possibility for leadership in terms of politics globally, as a, you know, a very progressive and also very responsible response to the collapse of the neoliberal centrist consensus in the world.
Dr. Ackerman, one of the things that President López Obrador promised was to attack corruption and crime. He also reopened the case of 43 missing student teachers or teachers in training. What do you think he can do realistically about the drug cartels and about drug-related crime in Mexico?
Well, two big issues which are related, of course. One is the issue of corruption. There, I'm not objective. My wife is, for full disclosure, be clear about this as well, has just started her new job as part of the López Obrador cabinet. She's the secretary of the public function, who's going to be in charge of combating and rooting out corruption in the entire federal government.
That's fantastic.
And she's an academic too from the UNAM. Her family has been participating in progressive left-wing politics for a long time from the state of Guerrero. She's an outsider in terms of politics herself. She's never really done some political stuff, but more of an academic expert on these issues. And now she's going to have an opportunity to exercise it in practice. And yes, that is the key to also combating the narcos and the organized crime. The new Secretary of Public Security, Alfonso Durazo, has said it very explicitly. He says that in order to root out organized crime, we need to first root out uniformed crime. Right? So this means that he is accepting that the Mexican state has been infiltrated by the drug cartels. In the protest in favor of, you know, the 43 students from Ayotzinapa, the big call on the streets was against the narco state, right? It wasn't just, you know, for trying to find the particular policemen who were responsible for disappearing the students, but their responsibility was to the top, and people were accusing the Mexican state of having turned into a narco state. So, and López Obrador himself has said, you know, corruption, we need to root it out from the top to the bottom, just as we sweep the stairs, right? Top to bottom. Doesn't make much sense to sweep down to from the bottom to the top. You can do it from the top to the bottom, because that's where the real problem is, up on the top. So that's going to be the real struggle. In terms of specific strategies for, you know, law enforcement and public security, what we have is a very interesting synthesis of different strategies, talking about very possible legalization of marijuana, and perhaps even some extracts or derivatives of opium in terms of medical use. He's talking about amnesty for, you know, lower level people, you know, not lower level, but, you know, people who don't are high ranking in the drug cartels, you know, youth and peasants who have been tied up with these criminal rings, and offering them instead, you know, price supports for the countryside, for the peasants, scholarships for youth. He said he wants no youth to have to be forced either to migrate or to go to the crime. They should be able to have guaranteed access either to higher education or to a job. You know, he said setting up a program of apprenticeships for youth. He's going to talking about over 2 million scholarships for youth who want to work. The idea is that this, you know, an apprenticeship program with existing businesses, and which the government pays a salary for the first few years, and then the corporation works them into the formal economy after that. And so, you know, prison reform is another big topic there, of course, because Mexican prisons, as many in the United States as well, are, you know, schools for crime. And in general, the idea is to move towards a situation of peace instead of war. You know, Calderón and Peña Nieto have been, you know, basically following the dictates of Washington, militarizing the strategy. He is going to maintain, and this has been highly criticized, some parts of the military in the streets. What he says is that it would be irresponsible for him to sort of pull out the military from one day to the next, and because this would leave the Mexican people in a state of lack of protection against these violent criminals. And also he says that in the end, at least the troops of the military, if not the high brass, but the troops are pueblo. They're people just like you and I who are also interested in social justice. And so he doesn't want to, you know, see the entire military as the enemy, but change its role and its focus and defending human rights instead of fulfilling these orders from Washington as they've been behaving over the last few years.
That was the voice of Dr. John Ackerman. Dr. Ackerman is a professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, researcher at the Legal Research Institute of UNAM, and editorial director of the Mexican Law Review. Let's talk about Mexico's relationship with the United States. The United States is there. It's not going to go anywhere. It has its own priorities, its own policies, its own orientation, not only towards Mexico, but towards the region as a whole. It's an inescapable reality for any political leader in Mexico, any head of state. How will he manage? Because obviously López Obrador, far, far, far different from Bolsonaro or Trump or Macron, and perhaps closer politically to the left movement and the left governments in the Latin America than certainly to the Trump administration or any American administration. But where do you think U.S.-Mexican relations will go? What will his tactic be here?
So López Obrador has been very pragmatic and strategic, right, about his relationship with Trump. He, you know, a couple of years ago when Trump came in, of course, he came out and has always systematically denounced the racist and the fascist expressions on Donald Trump against Mexico and Mexicans. But now as president, he's trying to be much more careful in terms of not sort of just blowing up the relationship, because, of course, Mexico and the United States both depend a lot on each other. You know, over 80% of Mexican exports go to the United States. Mexico is also, as you know, very important trade partner to the United States. I think we're number three in terms of the countries the United States trades to. So it's not like this can just sort of be suspended or not like anybody even wants to on the left or the right of the center. And so what López Obrador is trying to do is strategically move into the arena and start to place the interests of working people on both sides of the border in the center of the debate. You can see actually this guy, his one of his most important policy speeches, and this was about 2 years ago. This was in, I think it was February, March of 2016, in which he, 17 it would have been, Trump was inaugurated and
January 20th, 2017.
Okay, so this was a couple months after Trump was inaugurated. This would have been March of 2017. You can read it, actually. I sent the website of NACLA. His speech that he gave in, it translated to English, the speech he gave in Los Angeles, which was very profound in terms of, it spoke about his approach to U.S.-Mexico relationships. He says that, you know, the problem is not the United States as such, or not even Trump. The problem is that Trump is lying to his own bases, which are, you know, mostly working Americans, United States citizens, and that his objective is going to try to, you know, bring together these interests of working people on both sides of the border. And he cites, you know, Franklin Roosevelt as a great example of a progressive leader in the United States, that the United States should recuperate that tradition. In other speeches, he's talked about Kennedy, for instance, his good neighbor policy towards Latin America. So he's trying to convince Trump, I mean, you know, that might be a little bit naive, if you guys could tell me, but convince Trump and convince in general the people in the United States that, you know, López Obrador is not anti-American at all. He's looking to work with the more, you know, progressive, and then the whole of the establishment in order to improve the conditions of life in North America. We'll see what happens with the, you know, NAFTA 2. This would have to be approved by the Mexican Senate. The Mexican Senate has its own views, its own position on this stuff, and so if it's not a good deal for Mexico, I don't think it's going to get passed. It's not enough for Peña Nieto, the outgoing president, to have signed this letter of intention with Trump last Friday on his last day of office for Peña Nieto. This is going to have to be processed also by the new Mexican institutions.
Dr. Ackerman, one of the things that that the Trump administration has been so concerned about is the number of Central American migrants making their way to the southern U.S. So many of them are essentially stuck in Mexico. Does President López Obrador have a plan for what to do with these migrants? Are they going to remain in Mexico or be processed into the United States?
It's a big question. I wrote about this last week. I think it was Wednesday or Thursday. It was published in the New York Daily News, talking about the migrant crisis and the relationship between Mexico and the United States and what López Obrador's decisions are going to be. We still have to, you know, it's an open question at this moment. What López Obrador has said is that he is going to enforce Mexican law, which is actually very progressive, right? So Mexican migration law gives migrants very clear protections to human rights, to the right to transit through Mexican territory. That would not allow Mexico to sort of wall off its southern border, nor create big detention centers, or continue on, you know, what has been happening with Peña Nieto. The Peña Nieto has been, you know, expelling, deporting Central Americans at a much higher rate than the United States itself. He's been serving as the, you know, the attack dog, or the extension of the border patrol for Trump. That's going to stop, definitely. And so the thing that's on the table right now that Trump wants to convince López Obrador to do is this idea of the third safe country, you know, which forces people to apply for asylum from Mexico, not in the United States. It remains to be seen whether Mexico will accept this. López Obrador has said publicly that he's not going to accept it. I think in this negotiating space, López Obrador is a much better negotiator and has a much, on the other hand, he has a much stronger political legitimacy and base support in Mexico. And so I think that it's not going to be so easy for Trump to sort of ram this down López Obrador's throat and force Mexico to become the third safe country. López Obrador has said that what he really wants to do is develop the south of Mexico and Central America. They attack the root causes for migration, allow Mexicans and Central Americans the right to stay where they are, because most of these families would love to have a happy, satisfied life in their own communities. Migration is a painful thing. It implies lots of suffering. And, you know, the real way to solve this problem, if you want to call it a problem, is by creating jobs and development in the or originating communities. And so that's sort of what López Obrador is offering to Trump. He's saying, well, okay, I'll help you stop the migrants, if that you want to put it that way, but the way I'm going to stop them is by creating jobs in southern Mexico and Central America. Why don't you help me with that? And so that's the stage the negotiations were at. You know, Trump wanted to force the third safe country, Lipschroeder insisting on development in the South, and we'll see how it plays out.
That makes perfect sense.
Sure does.
You know, I lived in New York City in 1994 when NAFTA went into effect. I went with a small delegation, including Ramsey Clark, to Chiapas when the Zapatista uprising started in the first week of January when NAFTA went into effect. The Zapatista leadership at that time said NAFTA is going to be a death sentence for indigenous people. At that time, Dr. Ackerman, there were almost no Mexicans living in New York City. There were a lot of other people. But, you know, within a decade, there were, you know, tens of thousands, maybe more than 100,000 Mexicans living in New York City. And the Zapatistas were right, or the policy of neoliberalism that NAFTA represents, they were right. I mean, that's why people leave their homes, not because they want to. They can't survive.
Exactly. NAFTA was, has been a death sentence for the countryside. And yeah, the mass influx of migration dates is precisely the beginning of NAFTA. It's not just NAFTA. It's the neoliberal policies which have been locked in by NAFTA. And those 10 years, from 94 to 2004, over 500,000 Mexicans crossed the border every year, up to, you know, the maximum was around 98, almost 800,000 Mexicans in 1 year migrated to the United States. And so, yeah, this is a major mass migration from Mexico to the United States as a result of these policies. So what you're getting today is a result of U.S. policies. When you linked that to the support for Central American dictators, right, and electoral fraud, for instance, Honduras specifically, you get a much clearer picture of the whole thing.
We have 40 seconds left. Real quick, Dr. Ackerman, given the fact that López Obrador wants to do something really historic, really significant, he has a lot of support. He has a lot of enemies, though, within the Mexican establishment. I'm just thinking out loud here. Security must be uppermost in his mind as well, given the forces at play here. 30 seconds left.
Well, actually, he's been very free and open about that. He has not beefed up his security. He's actually disappeared the National Guard, and he's incorporated those soldiers into the Secretary of Defense, and he's also disappeared the FBI, the Internal Intelligence Service, which used to spy on, you know, opposition activists. He says he's trusting the people to defend him and protect him, and so this is a really bold thing to do, and fortunately, he does have the support. You know, the polls say that 85% of the Mexican population is excited and hopeful and optimistic about his achievements. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, he'll succeed because of the people. If he can succeed, it'll be because of the people. Really, really historic moment. We've been joined from Mexico City by Dr. John Ackerman, Professor of Constitutional Law at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, researcher at the Legal Research Institute of UNAM, and editorial director of the Mexican Law Review. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, the stock market went through the roof yesterday following the meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. There appeared to be a truce in the U.S.-initiated trade war with China. As we're doing this interview midday on Tuesday, however, that euphoria has proved itself to be very, very short-lived. The stock market at the moment is tanking. Who knows? It might go up, might go down. A lot of volatility. Anyway, let's start with the U.S.-China trade war. What do you expect? Is this a temporary truce, a prelude to a larger war? Or is it something stable?
I think this is really just political theater on the Trump side. As we were talking about earlier before I got on the show, you know, China hasn't actually commented in their state-run media on this meeting. So while in the U.S. and in the U.S. media sources are heralding it as some kind of big victory, and the Wall Street Journal has this big picture of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping shaking hands, that there's an easing of tensions, China isn't commenting on it in that way at all. So follow that up with the fact that we have Lighthizer being appointed as the guy in charge of discussing trade relations with China, someone who has been an advocate of tariffs as a way of pressuring other countries into allowing U.S. markets to enter their countries using, you know, restrictive tariffs and things like that. Really a similar trade policy to Trump ever since at least the Reagan administration, where he was involved in trade policy there. This is more of the same, really. So Trump is trying to play it off like he got real tough with China, and then China bowed and gave Trump all this stuff that he wanted. And so Trump is going to back off on the tariffs a little bit. But the truth is, if you appoint Lighthizer to that position, this is no change in policy. This is no change in stance. And what you saw yesterday was the markets initially reacting to what seemed to be good news, what seemed to be a sort of detente between the U.S. and China. And today they're reacting to the fact that Lighthizer has been appointed, the fact that China does not seem to have anything to say about the trade deal, which is not good because it shows that they don't feel like there's any kind of peace being made. And the markets are reacting to that. They're crashing because, of course, this trade war between China and the U.S. benefits little to nobody except very particular sectors of U.S. commerce and hurts the vast majority of people. So it's not really good news. I think it's an escalation with the appointment of Lighthizer. I think Trump is going to use this to kind of bait and switch, which is a tactic he's used with a lot of negotiating strategies, a sort of kind of, oh, look, I'm softening, things are working out, only to appoint someone that's even more hardline or as hardline in place. So really, you know, what this administration has shown is that it has no interest in giving anybody a sense of what it's going to do, what it wants to do, what its strategies are, and has been really kind of schizophrenic and will go back and forth between seeming to make peace with a country only to immediately appoint really aggressive people to be in charge of relationships with it.
Let's talk about that as an approach. Trump always pats himself on the back as the great deal maker. He wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. But, you know, it seems to me in terms of negotiations, you have to know, both sides have to know or sense what the other side bottom line is. And you certainly have to know what your own bottom line is, right? You can't really negotiate without knowing what your bottom line is.
Right.
If your bottom line is to look good or to get a momentary blip upwards in the media, that's actually okay for the media, but it's not really negotiations. It seems to me that the Chinese have had this very steady bottom line. They know what's important to them. They know what's important economically. They know what's important geostrategically, say with the issue of Taiwan. But nobody actually knows what Donald Trump's bottom line is. What is his bottom line? I mean, that's not a good negotiating style.
I'm not sure Donald Trump knows what his bottom line is.
Well, that's what I mean. If you have to know your adversary's bottom line, yes. But you have to at least know your own bottom line.
At least know your own. But like you and I have said on this show before, he appears to just be winging it. I don't think he really stands for anything. And then on an issue as complicated as this, I don't think he has the interest in the details. And so he's just winging it.
He came out, Daniel, we were on the air yesterday with somebody, with John Ross, who's an expert on China. And we were reading Trump's comments on Air Force One, where he was like crowing about the deal. This is big. This is incredible. All caps. Our farmers are going to, you know, be the big beneficiaries. Of course, the reason the farmers were suffering was that Chinese were retaliating against Donald Trump's own economic tariffs on China, which they would be required to retaliate against, like not buying soybeans, for instance. You have all these farmers in the Midwest who were deciding a couple months ago, let's not grow soybeans anymore because guess what? The Chinese, our biggest consumer, are not going to buy them. And then a month later, Trump makes a deal and says, oh, the farmers are going to be the big beneficiaries. They're going to make lots of money. They're going to be able to sell soybeans. Well, some of them just stopped planting soybeans. They just changed their crop rotation. It would seem to me that this kind of uncertainty isn't helpful to any sector of any part of the economy at all.
No, it's not helpful at all. And I agree. I think that Donald Trump has some really uninformed, very hardline ideological advisors telling him how he should treat China. People that don't really understand the very complicated country that China is and the very complex relationship it has with the U.S., that just see tariffs as this sort of way of the U.S. can exert its might and, you know, kick sand in the face of China and do whatever it wants and doesn't understand all these complicated downstream effects that will come from it. Trump understands even less. But these are his advisors that he's appointed, and he's going to go with what they say. So if they got an Air Force One and they say, yeah, this was a great thing, we should talk about how great we are, Trump's going to write it up on Twitter, and then boom, there you go. But I agree, there doesn't seem to be a strategy, which is why we see such volatility in the markets, because the markets don't know which way to go. There's these very wealthy, powerful investors, which is really who we're talking about when we talk about the markets. And since, you know, early days, what they have expected is a president that is going to signal and let them know, generally speaking, what direction they're moving in, what sort of actions they're going to take, what sort of policy overall and vision they have for the U.S. economy. And all Trump has been is kind of this sort of anti-China, anti-immigrant, kind of not really anti-Russia, sort of pressured into it at times, but this very chaotic, unclear strategy. That somehow we're going to bring back manufacturing jobs, which a lot of investors don't want because it's not profitable for these companies. They can get much more profit from exploiting cheap labor abroad. And it's not a lot of clarity. So you have companies like, you know, the automakers signaling that they're going to be losing billions of dollars because of these tariffs. So investors are panicking about that. You have a president that doesn't seem to really care. So when their billion-dollar losses result in layoffs, the president just gets mad and sort of shakes his fist at them. It's a sort of incompetent kind of impotence. And that's why you see such volatility in the markets, because nobody's really sure what he's going to do next. Maybe he'll slap 50% tariffs on them, you know, next week. Maybe he'll remove all tariffs tomorrow. It's really hard to say. And they just kind of, the markets go up and down based on some, you know, ill-placed tweets by Donald Trump.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst in Northern California. We're joined every Tuesday by Daniel Sankey on this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear this show, Loud and Clear, every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can subscribe to the show as a podcast at iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio. You can listen to it on Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at LoudClearRadio, at LoudClearRadio. And you can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at SputnikNews.com. Daniel Sankey, let's go on to another story. Amazon, this was a story that came out a couple days ago, not surprising, but it has big, big implications. Amazon is doing its prototypes to have entire stores, Amazon brick and mortar stores, retail stores without any cashiers. Talk about that, because we see New York City and New York State are just giving Amazon, have just given Amazon a big subsidy. So has Northern Virginia, big subsidies because everybody was trying to attract Amazon's HQ2, the second headquarters from Seattle. But here you see, again, a clear indication that Amazon is not a job creator.
And there's another thing, too, if I could add, before Daniel responds. There was a piece on CNN just last night saying that Walmart is going to begin experimenting with robots that sweep and mop the floors. And so what they'll do, like a Roomba, just set this thing, turn it on and lock up at night. And when you come back in the morning, the floors are clean.
And they don't complain.
And they don't complain, and they don't ask for health insurance, and they don't try to join a union.
Yeah. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a really significant change. I read into the article and tried to understand exactly how this would work. And it seemed to imply that there'd be some kind of facial recognition technology and biometrics that would allow Amazon to charge people's like Amazon account when they left the store or something like that. It wasn't totally clear. And then I also kind of wonder about theft, like if there's nobody there, wouldn't it be easy to just grab some sandwiches and run? I suppose that's something that they're thinking through.
They can get rid of cashiers and have a police.
Yeah, that's true. It's possible they could just have the public police force step in and do that. They certainly have enough money and an outsized footprint there to do it.
When I went to Whole Foods yesterday here in Washington, D.C., there is a Washington Metropolitan Police Department officer, full gear.
What?
Yeah.
At the Whole Foods.
At Whole Foods, armed to the teeth. Standing there by the cashiers. Now, they're wearing their MPD outfit, their uniform.
Yeah.
Assuming Whole Foods is paying them to come in. But yeah, you can just get rid of the workers, because this is the other part of the discussion right now. Amazon bought Whole Foods, and everybody's going to get a big discount. And you can use your Amazon Prime. But this article, the new article about this, is talking about Jeff Bezos wants to get rid of the cashiers at Whole Foods possibly as well. In other words, this isn't just new stores. This could be revamping what retail looks like.
Exactly. And to add to what you said, Brian, the Apple store in San Francisco that we go to has police force out in front of it. So this is not unusual. This is what companies do. I'm not sure if they pay for it or it's just subsidized by the city, but it is what it is. It's kind of like a private police force, really. So what Amazon wants to do is obviously create this technology that we don't need cashiers anymore, which would eliminate a huge amount of jobs. I have no reason to think that they won't be able to develop the technology to do it over time. Maybe it won't happen as fast as they want it to. But I think that they'll probably be able to develop it. If that does happen, it's going to force other retailers to either do the same. So that's why we talk about Walmart is kind of dipping its toe into that technology. Or smaller stores are going to go out of business because they can't possibly compete with the price that Amazon will then pass on the savings to the consumer, right? So it doesn't have to pay this workforce anymore. That becomes pure profit. And it can start bankrupting the bodegas and smaller stores and little grocery stores around the neighborhood, which is, of course, Amazon's business model. It goes in, it takes losses intentionally to bankrupt the market around it. Once the market goes belly up, it then takes over that market and now it can price fix because it has monopoly control over that area, which is exactly what you'll start seeing in places that allow Amazon to sort of set up shops like this, sort of like Virginia and New York, which is allowing its HQ 2 and 3 or whatever you want to call it, into its areas. So it won't be a job creator because it won't just eliminate jobs for Amazon workers. It'll eliminate jobs for the surrounding communities and neighborhood who are employing people to stock their shelves and ring up groceries who are going to go out of business because they can't compete. So it's going to have a net job loss effect by a long shot, and it will allow Amazon to continue its kind of monopoly control. It's really quite frightening and remarkable technology that it's able to do this and able to set this up in such a way that they don't need checkers anymore.
I think it's you get an app, right?
Yes.
And you walk into the store and everything you pick up and put into a bag that the store provides you is automatically registered as a price, and you automatically pay it as you leave the store. So They have the technology to be able to sense what you've put into your bag, charge you for it, and probably have an automatic payment process also with the app. It would seem like that's where this goes. And the article about it in the Wall Street Journal has some people saying, no, we know the workers here. We like the workers. There's good customer service at Whole Foods. But other people are saying, no, that sounds really cool. That sounds really convenient. We can just walk in, you know, put stuff in the bag and walk out. For convenience sake, because it's expeditious, and also because Amazon will make more profit, whether it's good for the customer or not, that'll be the driver of this.
Yeah, that'll be the driver of it. And also one thing let's not forget is the marketing data. So they're going to be tracking what you pick up, from where you pick up, how long you're in the store, when you leave. They're going to have a huge amount of data they're going to collect from that they're going to sell to advertisers. It's sort of like Google tracking your browsing history and selling it, only this is what you do in real life wandering around a store. They're going to have facial recognition technology. They're going to have cameras there with that equipped in them. So it'll be this creepy kind of surveillance state within Amazon under the guise of sort of convenience and being able to grab a sandwich and leave without having to interact with another human being and then slide your credit card. That's kind of what I worry about, because it's also just an extension of the surveillance state under the guise of, you know, customer, benefits or something like that, and elimination of jobs. So you can, if they do implement this, you can just wait and see. I'm sure they'll start sharing that data with law enforcement and other agencies like that just as soon as they can. And then, you know, in 4 years or whatever, it'll come out that they were sharing all this data pseudo-legally, and everybody will be, you know, horrified and appalled, but probably not a whole lot will happen. So that's another thing that kind of distresses me too, is that particular data sharing and recording of your information.
Yeah, and Amazon already has a $600 million contract with CIA, and I think they're bidding for, or may already have gotten, they will get it, a $10 billion contract with the Pentagon.
For cloud technology, I think
yeah.
It is.
So yeah, I mean, this is the integration of the biggest monopoly corporations, the richest people. Jeff Bezos has, what, $168 billion. It goes up and down a few billion every day.
Yeah, right.
And merged with the surveillance state, with intelligence services, and with the military.
And the media.
Daniel Sankey, we have to do what the French are doing right now. It works.
Absolutely. I mean, think about this, right?
Every day this week, we're going to say we have to act like the way the French are acting, because that's the only thing that actually can win.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be paid for politicians by the same military industrial surveillance state corporate complex.
Not to get too far off the subject, but you know, Time Magazine just, what, a year ago during rioting in Baltimore compared the summer of 17 to the summer of 68. And a lot of people thought there was a movement afoot and it kind of petered out. Well, maybe people are going to start taking their cues from the French.
Well, they have for the last couple centuries. I mean, the French have been in the vanguard of rights. And, you know, Michael Moore, we're really getting off track here, but Michael Moore made the point in his movie Sicko. He said, when the government fears the people get health care. Like, if the people fear the government, then you don't have healthcare. Meaning, if you're really depending on government largesse or the niceties and the beneficence of the rich, you're not going to get anything. But if they're scared of you, if they're scared that people can raise heck about these kind of social and economic disparities, then the government could say, "Yeah, let's make some concessions to people. Let's give them something." Otherwise, no, they're not going to give us anything. They're going to give all the money to Amazon so they can set up another headquarters in Long Island City or Crystal City, Virginia, to ruin, not create jobs.
When I look at the French and, you know, over the last decades or so and even longer, they really have been the vanguard of, you know, working class power. And I've always been really jealous of that and wish that, gosh, I wish in the U.S. we could get inspired by that or we could become aware of it.
We're announcing it right here on Loud and Clear. The American people are going to start acting like French working class people.
That's right. We're mad as hell and we're not going to take this anymore.
That's John Kiriakou speaking. Okay, Daniel, let's turn to some of the other big economic issues of the week.
Absolutely. I was brought a particular article up on the Supreme Court is to rule on a Kavanaugh appeals case that the SEC brought against a broker. So why I thought this was particularly interesting is it obviously raised Kavanaugh's name. But the Securities and Exchange Commission's job is, amongst other things, to ensure that Ponzi schemes and frauds don't take advantage of everyday investors, that brokers and other investors don't misrepresent things to the everyday person and take advantage of them, is charging a particular broker and his firm with basically lying to customers. What they said was that there was this waste disposal system that used human waste and turned it into energy, and that it was just this incredible new technology that had been created when, in fact, you know, the testing showed that it did little to nothing. What I thought was interesting about this case was that the broker who sent out the emails to all the potential clients saying, look at this amazing technology we discovered, it turns waste into energy, you should invest with us, was charged by the SEC for lying because the information didn't show that. And Kavanaugh, who is not going to rule on it as a Supreme Court judge, but did rule it in the previous appeals case, said that this was a terrible overreach by the SEC. And the reason was because the broker who sent out the emails was told by his boss to send out those emails. And therefore, the broker was not responsible for anything that he'd said, that it was entirely at the behest of his boss and therefore not his fault at all. I thought this was particularly interesting because this is, of course, the person who's now been appointed to the Supreme Court, who is essentially making a decision defending this guy participating in a scheme to defraud people. And let me point out, the person who sent out those emails made a lot of money off of this. They were not some sort of frontline secretary that was, you know, just answering phone calls. They were making a lot of money off of defrauding these people. And this is the sort of person that we've now appointed to the Supreme Court, who's willing to limit this regulatory body, the Securities and Exchange Commission, who is trying to protect people from getting defrauded and ripped off by different, you know, investment scams, and basically said, well, you know, he was told to do it by his boss, so he can do whatever he wants. So there's no moral culpability. There's no responsibility. You can lie to people just as long as you're, you know, as the guy, the other guy tells you to do it. And I thought this was of particular interest and kind of worth raising, because this is sort of the type of person we're going to see coming down the line in the Supreme Court, as if we didn't already know. Aside from, you know, his obvious sexual, you know, violence and improprieties that he engaged in, this is the type of anti-worker, kind of pro-corporate protector that they're going to have. So you can, you know, openly defraud people and know that, you know, people in high places will make sure that you get, you know, defended and protected from your actions.
I think this is an important topic because, you know, the way it got politically polarized, a lot of Republican working class voters may have supported Kavanaugh because they thought, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony was part of a Democratic Party ambush against Kavanaugh. When I was thinking about that, I was saying, why did the Democrats wait until the last minute to raise that? Okay, there might be a reason, because Dr. Christine Blasey Ford only said she wanted to come forward at the end of the process. But they could have attacked Kavanaugh like crazy as the enemy of working people, because he really is. Like, you go through his thing, he's for the bosses, he's for the corporations, he's for the banks, he's the enemy of workers. Wouldn't that have been a way to appeal to Republican voting workers who maybe voted for Trump to expose Kavanaugh's real record? And this isn't a Democrat-Republican thing. This is a class thing. He is the enemy of workers. He is the friend of the corporate bosses who want to hurt workers, who have been hurting workers for four decades. But the Democrats didn't do it. And the reason they didn't do it is they have the same policies as Kavanaugh, more or less, when it comes to corporations and banks. They've been the great friends of Wall Street. That's why they couldn't really sort of penetrate into Trump's base and expose Kavanaugh for who he is, because they're the same. They're essentially the same.
That's a really important point. If we think about Donald Trump and all the different ways we could oppose him politically, sexism, racism, bigotry, anti-environmentalism, you know, climate change denial, there's all these issues that people could rally around. But what did the Democratic Party decide? They decided to invent Russiagate, and that we should hate Donald Trump because somehow he has some kind of connection with this foreign power. That's the reason we should be upset and riled up about him, which is, of course, ridiculous. And now with the Kavanaugh thing, it's the same sort of thing. You could go after Kavanaugh on a wide variety of issues, and they chose this particular one. But if the idea is to sort of defame him, just look at his, you know, record as a judge and where he's ruled. He has consistently come out in favor of the bosses, consistently come out in favor of wealth, has, you know, deep connections to the Trump presidency and family and friends there. All this could have been exposed, and all this could have rallied people around it, including, you know, more right-leaning people. But as you point out, they would never do that because that's not who funds them. Corporations fund them.
Meaning the Democrats. Yeah, yeah.
Corporations fund the Democrats. Goldman Sachs funds the Democrats. So they're not going to come out against all these issues which are ultimately beneficial towards these corporate interests. They're going to come out with these sort of vaguer things like Russia or something like that as a way of somehow opposing it, because, of course, they want to make sure they get those donations next election cycle.
And also they can prove to the military-industrial complex that their narrative is friendly to more military spending, because conflict with Russia, well, that costs money. And that's a reason, a pretext to keep funding, sending all of our money to the military corporations. Daniel, we have less than 5 minutes. I want to come back to another important topic. Will there be another recession? Of course, there will be. But the question is when. I want you to help us understand as best you can in layperson's terms what this particular specific issue might mean. I'm going to read now to you from the Wall Street Journal. It's today. It's above the fold. The headline is Markets Send Conflicting Signals. And after they talk about the rise and fall of the stock market, and then its rise again and its fall, the volatility, the rise and fall of gas prices, here's what's written. Yet the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which typically rises with stocks when investors are optimistic about growth, closed below 3% for the first time since September. That slide squeezed the difference between the 10-year and 2-year Treasury yields to around 0.16 percentage points, the narrowest gap since 2007, and a sign many investors are pricing in slower growth ahead, meaning they're expecting a recession. Again, John and I were talking about how to torture people. We thought, well, this would be a good way to do it. Talk about something like this, inverted yields on long and short-term bonds. But it is important because the people paying attention on Wall Street take it as an indicator that recession is coming. Can you briefly explain what this is?
Yeah, without going into too much detail, because it's not entirely necessary, is investors and economists have used different mathematical models to determine what's going to happen next. And the ones that have consistently performed and predicted things accurately are the ones they generally speaking stick with. So what this inverted yield talks about is how this particular shift in pricing between short-term bonds, which are bonds that you invest in for a short period of time before getting your money back, and long-term bonds, that is bonds that you keep your money in for much longer before getting it back, is changing and reflecting in such a way that it predicts that there may be a recession coming. So what they're saying is this tried and true method of determining where recessions are, if they're coming, et cetera, is signaling that, yes, it's becoming closer to it. So that is in part why markets were in such bad shape today. Part of it was also around the China trade deal and uncertainty, which we discussed earlier. But part of it is around the treasury notes. And what it shows is that the returns expected on essentially loaning money to the U.S. government, that's a bond, is not what it used to be. And so they're worried that this is signaling that economic growth, or that investors don't believe in the sort of economic growth that they're potentially seeing in the United States. And so that's what it's essentially signaling now.
Daniel, let me interrupt you on that point. We have less than 2 minutes left, so I wanted to ask you if you could address short-term bonds versus long-term bonds. Short-term bonds are such a lower risk than long-term bonds, and so investors, especially institutional investors, like to put money in short-term bonds and then just cycle it over and over and over again. Long-term bonds have a lot more risk because they're sensitive to interest rate changes. With interest rates going up, it makes long-term bonds look worse because the yield goes down, correct? And then that further pushes us toward a recession.
So the point being that if you're buying a 10-year bond, which has greater risk,
right,
you're going to get more money from the government for having made that purchase. But now we see those returns are actually diminishing and coming close to what you would get if you made a short-term
precisely
loan, purchased a bond.
So if you're going to get, let's say, 3% with a short-term bond, and you're going to get 3.5% with a long-term bond, you'd be crazy to go with a long-term bond, right?
Yeah, exactly. What it means is that the profitability you get off the long-term bond doesn't justify the risk. And so what it means is investors are going to be less likely to do these longer term investments in US bonds and more likely to do the shorter term investments, which also means, though, that there will be more money flowing out of those bonds as they're saying, I don't think it's really worth the risk, and into equities, which is going to further inflate and kind of distort prices in equities. So when I say equities, I mean stocks, like the everyday stocks we know, like General Motors or AT&T. And that's going to produce more of an inflation in those prices as well, which distorts their real prices because it's just this artificial influx of money. So what it shows is that the United States bond is not as safe and as profitable as it once was, which is really interesting because in a lot of ways, it's kind of the quote unquote safe as houses. When we see this change, when we see investors starting to lose faith in the United States profitability, basically, and their ability to pay back these debts and that they're a good investment, that can signal recession. Because it's not just about not having faith in GM or AT&T or something like that. It's the United States and the U.S. economy, which is showing that it's not as profitable.
And we could see Russia got rid of its bond holdings, I believe. And China, which holds, perhaps is the largest holder of U.S. bonds, also selling them, not buying more. Anyway, we'll see. Of course, Daniel Sankey, we'll talk next week again about the dangers of a coming recession and what it means for working people. But for right now, we are out of time. That was Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.